They can't...
Not they, Mr. President. One man. One godless man. When will you speak to your people about this?
Soon, Ryan replied. Please, Jack, this is not our religion. This is not our faith. Please tell your people that.
I know that, Your Highness. It isn't about God, it's about power. It always is.
I'm afraid I have other things to do.
As do I. I must see the king.
Please give him my respects.
We stand together, Ali, just like before.
With that, the line went dead.
Next, where exactly is Adler right now?
Shuttling back to Taiwan, Rutledge answered.
Those negotiations were still going on, though their purpose was now rather clear.
Okay, he has secure comlinks on the plane. You brief him in, he told the undersecretary.
Anything else I need to do right now?
Sleep, Admiral Jackson told him.
Let us do the all-nighter, Jack.
That's a plan.
Ryan rose. He wobbled a bit from the stress and lack of sleep.
Wake me up if you need me.
We won't, nobody said.
Well, Captain Kemper said, reading the critic message from Cinclant, that makes things a lot simpler.
Range to the Indian battle group was now 200 miles, about 8 hours of steaming. Still the term they used, though all the combatant ships were now powered by jet turbine engines. Kemper lifted the phone and flipped a switch to speak on the ship's 1MC address system.
Now hear this. This is the captain speaking.
Task Group Comedy is now at DEFCON 1. That means if anybody gets close, we shoot him. The mission is to deliver our tank carriers to Saudi Arabia. Our country is flying in the soldiers to drive them, in anticipation of an attack on our allies in the region by the new United Islamic Republic. In 16 hours we will link up with a surface action making a speed run down from the Med. We will then enter the Persian Gulf to make our delivery. The group will have friendly air cover in the form of Air Force F-16C fighters. But it is to be expected that the UIR, our old Iranian friends, will not be happy with our arrival. USS Anzio is going to war, people. That is all for now.
He flipped the switch back.
Okay, let's start running simulations. I want to see everything those bastards might try on us. We will have an updated intelligence estimate here in 2 hours. For now, let's see what we can do about aircraft and missile attacks.
What about the Indians? Weps asked.
We'll be keeping an eye on them, too. The main tactical display showed a P-3C Orion passing Comedy to relieve the aircrafts now on station. The battle group was heading east, again recrossing its wake, as it had been doing for some time now. A KH-11 satellite was just sweeping down northwest to southeast over the Persian Gulf. Its cameras, having already looked at the three heavy corps of the Army of God, were now photographing the entire Iranian coast, looking for the launch sites of Chinese-made silkworm missiles. The take from the electronic cameras was cross-linked to a communication satellite over the Indian Ocean, and from there to the Washington area, where technicians, still wearing chemically impregnated surgical masks, started looking for the airplane-shaped surface-to-surface missiles. The fixed launch sites were well known, but the weapon could also be fired off the back of a large truck, and there were plenty of coastal roads to survey. The first group of 4 airliners touched down without incident outside Dhahran. There was no arrival ceremony. It was already hot. Spring had come early to the region, after the surprisingly cold and wet winter season, and that meant noon temperatures close to 100 degrees, as opposed to the 120 of high summer, but night temperatures down in the 40s. It was humid this close to the coast as well. When the first airliner stopped, the truck-mounted stairs were driven up, and Brigadier General Marion Diggs was the first off. He would be the ground commander for this operation. The virus epidemic still raging in America had also compromised MacDill Air Force Base in Florida, home of Central Command, which had responsibility for this area. The briefing papers he'd seen to this point said that the commander of the 366th Air Combat Wing was also a one-star, but junior to him. It had been a long time since so vital an operation had been turned over to someone as junior as himself, Marion Diggs thought on the way down the steps. At the bottom was a Saudi three-star. The two men exchanged salutes and entered a car for the ride to the local command post, and an intelligence update. Behind Diggs was the command group of the 11th ACR, and on the other three aircraft, a security group and most of the 2nd Squadron of the Black Horse. Buses waited to take them to the Palmcus site. It was all rather like the reforger exercises of the Cold War, which had anticipated a NATO-Warsaw Pact clash requiring American soldiers to get off the airplanes, board their vehicles, and march off to the front. This had never happened except in simulation. But now, again, it was happening, and this time it was for real. 2 hours later, 2nd of the Black Horse was rolling into the open.
"What do you mean?" Darii asked.
"There appears to be a major troop movement underway," his intelligence chief told him. "Radar sites in western Iraq have detected commercial aircraft entering Saudi Arabia from Israeli airspace. We also show fighters escorting them and patrolling the border."
"What else?"
"Nothing at the moment, but it would seem likely that America is moving another force into the kingdom. I am not sure what it could be. Certainly it cannot be very large. Their German-based divisions are under quarantine, and all their home-quartered divisions are in the same condition. Most of their army is actually deployed for internal security."
"We should attack them anyway," his Air Force advisor urged.
"I think that would be a mistake," intelligence said. "It would be an invasion of Saudi airspace, alerting those goatherds too soon. The Americans can at most move one brigade-sized force. There is a 2nd based at Diego Garcia, the equipment, that is. But we have no information to suggest that it has moved. And even if it does, we expect that our Indian friends can stop it."
"We trust pagans?" Air Force asked with contempt.
That was how Muslims viewed the official religion of the subcontinent. "We can trust their antipathy to America, and we can ask them if their fleet has spotted anything. In any case, the Americans can deploy another brigade-sized force. That is all."
"Kill it anyway."
"That throws away operational security," intelligence pointed out.
"If they don't know we are coming by now, then they are fools," Air Force objected.
"The Americans have no reason to suspect that we have taken hostile actions against them. To attack their aircraft, if that's what they are, will alert them unnecessarily, not just the Saudis. They are probably concerned about our troop movements in Iraq. So they fly in some small reinforcements. We can deal with them when the time comes," intelligence told them.
"I will call India," Darii said, temporizing.
"Navigation radars only. Make that 2-air search, probably from the carriers," the petty officer said. "Their course track is 090, speed about 16. The tactical officer on the Orion, called a TACO, looked down at his chart. The Indian battle group was at the extreme eastern edge of the racetrack pattern they'd been following for the last several days. In less than 20 minutes, they should reverse course to head west. If they turned, things would become exciting. Comedy was now 120 miles away from the other formation, and his aircraft was feeding constant information to Anzio and Kidd. Under the wings of the 4-engine Lockheed turboprop were 4 Harpoon missiles. White ones. War shots. The aircraft was now under the tactical command of Captain Kemper on Anzio. And on his order, they could launch those missiles, 2 each at the Indian carriers, because they were the long gun of the opposing navy. A few minutes behind would be a swarm of tomahawks, and more harpoons headed the same way.
"Are they MCON'd?" the officer wondered.
"With navsets emitting," the sailor replied.
"Comedy must have 'em on their ESM gear by now. Damn sure our guys are lighting up the sky, sir."
Comedy had essentially two choices. Adopt MCON, for emissions control, turning off their radars to make the other side expend time and fuel searching for them, or simply light everything off, creating an electronic bubble which the other side could easily see, but the penetration of which would be dangerous. Anzio had gone with the second option.
"Any airplane chatter?" the TACO asked another crewman.
"Negative, sir, none at all."
"Hmph."
As low as the Orion was flying, its presence was probably not known to the Indians, despite their use of air search gear. He was sorely tempted to pop up and illuminate himself with his own search radar. What were they up to? Might a few ships have broken away from the group, heading west, say, to launch an off-axis missile attack? He couldn't know what they were saying or thinking. All he had were computer-generated course tracks based on radar signals. The computer knew exactly where aircraft was at all times off the global positioning satellite system. From that, the bearing to the radar sources enabled calculation of their location and...
"Course change?"
"Negative. System shows them still leading 090 at 16 knots.
They are passing out of the box now, sir. This is farther east than we've seen them in 3 days. They are now 30 miles east of Comedy's course to the strait."
"I wonder if they changed their minds about this."
"Yes, our fleet is at sea," the Prime Minister told him.
"Have you seen the American ships?"
The leader of the Indian government was all alone in her office. Her foreign minister had been in earlier, and was on his way back at this moment. This phone call had been anticipated but not hoped for. The situation had changed. President Ryan, weak though she still thought him to be, who else but a weak man would have threatened a sovereign country so, had nonetheless frightened her. What if the plague in America had been initiated by Darii? She had no evidence that it had, and she would never seek such information out. Her country could never be associated with such an act. Ryan had asked, what was it, 4 times? 5? For her word that the Indian Navy would not hinder the American fleet movement. But only 1 time had he said weapons of mass destruction. That was the deadliest code phrase in international exchange. All the more so, her foreign minister had told her, because America only possessed 1 kind of such weapons, and for that reason, America regarded biological weapons and chemical weapons to be nuclear weapons. That led to another calculation. Aircraft fought aircraft. Ships fought ships. Tanks fought tanks. One answered an attack with the same weapon used by one's enemy. Full power and rage, she remembered also. Ryan had overtly suggested that he would take action based on the nature of the supposed attack by the UIR. Nor, finally, did she discount the lunatic attack on his little daughter. She remembered that from the East Room, the reception after the funeral, how Ryan doted on his children. Weak man though he had to be, he was an angry weak man, armed with weapons more dangerous than any others. Darii had been foolish to provoke America in that way. Better just to have launched his attack on Saudi and win with conventional arms on the field of battle. And that would have been that. But no. He had to try to cripple America at home, to provoke them in a way that was the purest form of lunacy. And now she and her government and her country could be implicated, the PM realized. She hadn't bargained for any of that. Deploying her fleet was chance enough. And the Chinese, what had they done? Launched an exercise, perhaps damaged that airliner, 5,000 kilometers away. What risks were they taking? Why, none at all.
Darii expected much of her country,
and with his attack on the very citizens of America, it was too much.
No, she told him, choosing her words carefully. Our fleet units have seen American patrol aircraft, but no ships at all. We have heard, as you perhaps have, that an American ship group is transiting Suez, but only warships and nothing more.
You are sure of this? Darii asked.
My friend, neither our ships nor our naval aircraft have spotted any American ships in the Arabian Sea at all.
The one overflight had been by land-based MiG-23s of the Indian Air Force. She hadn't lied to her supposed ally. Quite.
The sea is large, she added. But the Americans are not that clever, are they?
Your friendship will not be forgotten, Darii promised her.
The Prime Minister replaced the phone, wondering if she'd done the right thing.
Well, if the American ships got to the Gulf, she could always say that they hadn't been spotted. That was the truth, wasn't it? Mistakes happened, didn't they?
Heads up, I got 4 aircraft lifting off from Gasser Amu, a captain said aboard the AWACS. The newly constituted UIR Air Force had been working up too, but mainly over what was the central part of the new country, and hard to spot even from the airborne radar platform. Whoever had timed this wasn't doing all that badly. The 4th quartet of inbound airliners had just crossed into Saudi airspace, less than 200 miles from the UIR fighters doing their climb-out. It had been quiet on the airfront to this point. 2 fighters had been tracked over the last few hours, but those appeared to be check-ops from the mission profiles, probably aircraft that had been fixed for some major or minor defect, then taken up to see if the new widgets worked properly. But this was a flight of 4, which had taken off in 2 closely spaced elements. That made them fighters on a mission. The current air cover for Operation Custer, in this sector, was a flight of 4 American F-16s orbiting within 20 miles of the border.
Kingston lead, this is Skyeye 6, over.
Sky, lead.
We have 4 bandits, 035 your position, Angels 10 and climbing, course 290.
The 4 American fighters moved west to interpose themselves between the UIR fighters and the inbound airliners. Aboard the AWACS, a Saudi officer listened in to the radio chatter between the ground radar station controlling the flight of 4 and the fighters. The UIR fighters, now identified as French-made F-1s, continued to close the border, then turned 10 miles short of it, finally tracing only 1 mile inside. The F-16s did much the same, and the pilots saw each other and examined one another's aircraft from 4,000 yards apart, through the protective visors of their helmets. The air-to-air missiles were clearly visible under the wings of all the aircraft.
"Y'all want to come over and say hello?" the USAF major leading the F-16 said over guard. There was no response. The next installment of Operation Custer proceeded unhindered to Dharan.
O'Day was in early. His sitter, with no classes to worry about, rather enjoyed the thought of all the money that would come in from this. And the most important bit of news for everyone was that not a single case of the new illness had happened within 10 miles of his home. Despite the inconvenience, he had slept at home every night, even though, on one occasion, that had been a mere 4 hours. He couldn't be a daddy if he didn't kiss his little girl at least once a day, even in her sleep. At least the ride into work was easy. He'd gotten a bureau car. It was faster than his pickup, complete with a flashing light that allowed him to zip through all the checkpoints on the way. On his desk were the case summaries from the background checks of all the Secret Service personnel. The work in nearly every case had been stultifyingly duplicative. Full background checks had been done on every USSS employee, or else they could not have held the security clearances that were an automatic part of their jobs. Birth certificates, high school photos, and everything else matched up perfectly. But 10 files showed loose ends,
and all of those would be run down later in the day. O'Day went over all of them. He kept coming back to one. Raymond was of Iranian birth. But America was a nation of immigrants. The FBI had originally been constructed of Irish Americans, preferably those educated at Jesuit institutions. Boston College and Holy Cross were the favorites, according to the legend. Because J. Edgar Hoover was supposed to have believed that no Irish American with a Jesuit education could conceivably betray his country. Doubtless there had been some words about that at the time, and even today anti-Catholicism was the last of the respectable prejudices. But it was well known that immigrants so often made the most loyal of citizens, some ferociously so. The military and other security agencies often profited from that. Well, Pat thought, it was easily settled. Just check out the rug thing and let it be. He wondered who Mr. Sloan was. A guy who wanted a rug, probably. There was a quiet to the streets of Tehran. Clark didn't remember them that way from 1979 to 80. His more recent trip had been different, more like the rest of the region, bustling but not dangerous. Being journalists, they acted like journalists. Clark re-entered market areas, talking politely to people about business conditions, the availability of food, what they thought of the unification with Iraq, what their hopes for the future were. And what he got was pure vanilla. Platitudes. The political comments were especially bland, singularly lacking in the passion he remembered from the hostage crisis, when every heart and mind had been turned against the entire outside world, especially America. Death to America. Well, they'd given substance to that wish, John thought. Or someone had. He didn't sense that animus anymore among the people, remembering the strangely cordial jeweler. Probably they just wanted to live, just like everyone else. The apathy reminded him of Soviet citizens in the 1980s. They'd just wanted to get along, just wanted to live a little better, just wanted their society to respond to their needs. There was no revolutionary rage left in them. So why, then, had Darii taken his action? How would the people respond to that? The obvious answer was that he'd lost touch, as great men so often did. He'd have his coterie of true believers, and a larger number of people willing to ride the bus and enjoy the comfortable seating, while everyone else walked and kept out of the way. But that was it. It was fertile ground to recruit agents, to identify those who'd had enough and were willing to talk. What a shame that there was no time to run a proper intelligence operation here. He checked his watch. Time to head back to the hotel. Their first day had been both a waste and part of their cover. Their Russian colleagues would arrive tomorrow. The first order of business was to check out the names Sloan and Alahad. That started with a check of the telephone book. Sure enough, there was a Muhammad Alahad. He had an ad in the Yellow Pages, Persian and Oriental rugs. For some reason, people didn't connect Persia with Iran, a saving grace for a lot of rug merchants. The shop was on Wisconsin Avenue, about a mile from Raymond's apartment, which was not in the least way remarkable. Similarly, there was a Mr. Joseph Sloan in the crisscross, whose telephone number was 536-4040, as opposed to Raymond's 536-3040. A one-digit goof, which easily explained the wrong number on the Secret Service agent's answering machine. The next step was pure form. The computer records of telephone calls were run by command. The massive numbers of them took almost a minute to run, even with knowledge of the probable dates. And there it came up on the agent's screen. A call from 202-536-3040, from 202-459-6777. But that wasn't Alahad's store number, was it? A further check showed 6777 as a payphone 2 blocks from the shop. Odd. If he were that close to his shop, why drop a dime, actually a quarter now, to make the call?
Why not make another check?
The agent was his squad's techno-genius, with a mustache and a marginal haircut. He'd been something less than a raving success working bank robberies, but had found foreign counterintelligence to his liking. It was like the engineering classes of his college days. You just kept picking at things. He'd also found that the foreign spies he chased thought the same way he did. Toss in his technical prowess. In the past month, there had not been a call from the rug shop to 536-4040. He went back another month. No. How about the other direction? No, 536-4040 had never called 457-1100. Now, if he'd ordered a rug, and those things took time, must have if the dealer had called to let the guy know it had finally come in, why hadn't there been a call about it in either direction? The agent leaned over to the next desk.
Sylvia, want to take a look at this?
What is it, Donnie?
The Black Horse was fully on the ground now. Most of them were in their vehicles or attending their aircraft. The 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment comprised 123 M1A2 Abrams main battle tanks, 127 M3A4 Bradley scout vehicles, 16 M109A6 Paladin 155mm mobile guns, and 8 M270 multiple-launch rocket system tracks, plus a total of 83 helicopters, 26 of which were AH-54D Apache attack choppers. Those were the shooting platforms. They were supported by hundreds of soft vehicles, mostly trucks to carry fuel, food, and ammunition, plus 20 extras locally called water buffaloes, a vital need in this part of the world. The first order of business was to get everyone away from the Pomka site. The tracked vehicles were driven onto lowboy trailers for the ride north to Abu Hadria, a small town with an airport and the designated assembly point for the 11th Cav. As every vehicle rolled out of its warehouse, it stopped on a pre-selected spot painted red. There the GPS navigation systems were checked against a known reference point. Two of the IVIS boxes were down. One of them announced the fact all by itself, sending a coded radio message to the regiment's support troop, demanding that it be replaced and repaired. The other was completely dead, and the crew had to figure it out for themselves. The large red square helped. The trailer trucks were driven by Pakistanis, a few hundred of the thousands imported into the Saudi kingdom to do menial labor. For the Abrams and Bradley crews, it would prove to be exciting, while they worked inside their tracks to make sure that everything was working. With the routine tasks done, drivers, loaders, and commanders stuck their heads out of their hatches, hoping to enjoy the view. What they saw was different from Fort Irwin, but not terribly exciting. To the east was an oil pipeline. To the west was a lot of nothing. The crews watched anyway. The view was better than they'd experienced on the flight, except for the gunners, many of whom fought motion sickness, a common problem for people in that position. It was almost as bad for those who could see. The local truckers, it seemed, were paid by the mile and not the hour. They drove like maniacs. The guardsmen were beginning to arrive now. They had nothing to do at the moment except set up the tents provided for them, drink lots of water, and exercise. Supervisor Special Agent Hazel Loomis commanded this squad of 10 agents. Sissy Loomis had been an FCI from the beginning of her career, virtually all of it in Washington. Approaching 40 now, she still had the cheerleader look that had served her so well earlier in her time as a street agent. She also had a number of successful cases under her belt.
"This looks a little odd," Donnie Seelig told her, laying out his notes on her desk. It didn't require much by way of explanation. Phone contacts between intelligence agents never included the words, "I have the microfilm."
The most innocuous of messages were pre-selected to convey the proper information, which was why they were called code words. And it wasn't that the tradecraft was bad. It was just that if you knew what to look for, it looked like tradecraft. Loomis looked the data over, then looked up. "Got addresses?"
"You bet, sis," Selig told her.
"Then let's go see Mr. Sloan." The one bad part about promotion was that being a supervisor denied her the chance to hit the bricks. Not for this one, Loomis told herself. At least the F-15E Strike Eagle had a crew of two, allowing the pilot and weapons systems operator to engage in conversation for the endless flight. The same was true of the six B-1B bomber crews. The Lancer even had enough area that people could lie down and sleep, not to mention a sit-down toilet. This meant that, unlike the fighter crews, they didn't have to shower immediately upon reaching Al-Kharj, their final destination south of Riyadh. The 366th Air Combat Wing had three designated checkered flag locations throughout the world. These were bases in anticipated trouble spots, with support equipment, fuel, and ordnance facilities maintained by small caretaker crews, who would be augmented by the 366th's own personnel, mainly flying in by chartered airliners. That included additional flight crews, so that, theoretically, the crew which had flown in from Mountain Home Air Force Base in Idaho could indulge in crew rest, while another relief crew could theoretically fly the aircraft off to battle. Fortunately, for all concerned, this wasn't necessary. Thoroughly exhausted airmen, and now women, brought their birds in for landing, taxied off to their shelters, and dismounted, handing their charges over to maintenance personnel. The Bombay fuel tanks were removed first of all and replaced with the appliances made to hold weapons, while the crews went off for long showers and briefings from intelligence officers. Over a period of 5 hours, the entire 366th combat strength was in Saudi, less one F-16C, which had developed avionics trouble and diverted to Bentwaters Royal Air Force Base in England.
Yes?
The elderly woman wasn't wearing a surgical mask. Sissy Loomis handed her one. It was the new form of greeting in America. "Good morning, Mrs. Sloan," FBI, the agent said, holding up her ID.
"Yes?"
She wasn't intimidated, but she was surprised. "Mrs. Sloan, we're conducting an investigation, and we'd like to ask you a few questions. We just need to clear something up. Could you help us, please?"
"I suppose."
Mrs. Joseph Sloan was over 60, dressed neatly, and looked pleasant enough, if somewhat surprised by all this. Inside the apartment the TV was on turned to a local station by the sound of it. The weather forecast was running. "May we come in?" "This is Agent Don Selig," she said, nodding her head to the techno-weenie. As usual, her friendly smile won the day. Mrs. Sloan didn't even put the mask on.
"Surely."
The lady of the house backed away from the door. It took only a single glance to tell Sissy Loomis that something was not quite right here. For one thing, there was no Persian rug to be seen in the living room. In her experience, people didn't just buy one of the things. For another, this apartment was just too neat.
"Excuse me, is your husband in?" The response was immediate and pained. "My husband passed away last September," she told the agent. "Oh, I am sorry, Mrs. Sloan. We didn't know." And with that, a fairly routine follow-up changed into something very different indeed. "He was older than me. Joe was 78," she said, pointing to a picture on the coffee table of two people a long time ago, one about 30, and one in her late teens. "Does the name Alahad mean anything to you, Mrs. Sloan?" Loomis asked after sitting down. "No, should it?" "He deals in Persian and Oriental rugs." "Oh, we don't have any of those. I'm allergic to wool, you see."
Chapter 57
Night Passage.
Jack?
Ryan's eyes clicked open to see that there was bright sunlight coming through the windows. His watch said it was just after 8 in the morning.
What the hell? Why didn't anybody?
You even slept through the alarm, Kathy told him.
Andrea said that Arnie said to let you sleep till about now.
I guess I needed it too, Surgeon added. She'd been in bed for over 10 hours before waking at 7.
Dave told me to take the day off, she added.
Jack jolted up and moved at once into the bathroom. When he came back, Kathy, in her housecoat, handed over his briefing papers. The president stood in the center of the room reading them. Reason told him that if anything serious had happened, he would have been awakened. He had slept through the clock radio alarm before, but he'd never failed to be aroused by a phone. The papers told him that all was, if not exactly well, then relatively stable. 10 minutes after that, he was dressed. He took the time to say hello to his kids and kiss his wife. Then he headed out.
"Swordsman is moving," Andrea said into her radio mic.
"Sit room?" she asked POTUS.
"Yeah. Whose idea was it to—"
"Mr. President, that was the chief of staff. But he was right, sir." Ryan looked at her as she punched the elevator button for the ground floor.
"I guess I'm outvoted, then."
The national security team had clearly been up all night on his behalf. Ryan had coffee waiting at his place. They'd been living on it.
"Okay, what's happening over there?"
"Comedy is now 130 miles beyond the Indians. Would you believe they resumed their patrol station behind us?" Admiral Jackson told his commander-in-chief.
"Playing both sides of the street," Ben Goodley concluded.
"It's a good way to get hit by traffic in both directions," Arnie put in.
"Go on."
"Operation Custer is just about done. The 366th is also in Saudi, less one broke fighter that diverted to England. The 11th Cav is rolling out of its storage site to an assembly area."
"So far," the J-3 said, "so good. The other side sortied some fighters to the border, but we and the Saudis had a blocking force, and nothing happened aside from some mean looks."
"Anybody think they're going to back down?" Ryan asked.
"No." This came from Ed Foley. "They can't. Not now."
The rendezvous took place 50 miles off Cape Ras Al Had, the far southeast corner of the Arabian Peninsula. Cruisers Normandy and Yorktown, destroyer John Paul Jones, and frigates Underwood, Doyle, and Nicholas took a trailing position so that Platt and Supply could take them alongside after their high-speed run down from Alexandria to top off their bunkers. Helicopters ferried the captains to Anzio, whose captain was senior, for an hour's worth of discussion of the mission. Their destination was Dharan. To get there, they had to drive northwest into the Strait of Hormuz. Getting there would take just over 6 hours, 2,200 hours local time. The strait was 20 miles across and speckled with islands. Plus, it was one of the most heavily traveled waterways in the world, even now despite the growing crisis. Supertankers, one of which displaced more water than all of the warships in the now-designated TF-61.1 combined, were merely the best-known vessels transiting the area. There were also massive container ships wearing the flags of 10 nations, and even a multi-level sheep carrier, which looked like a big city parking garage, which was bringing in live mutton from Australia. The smell of it was famous on all the oceans of the world. The strait was covered by radar to establish traffic control. The possibility of a ramming incident between two supertankers didn't bear thinking about, which meant that TF-61.1 would be unlikely to sneak in entirely unnoticed. But they could do a few things. At the narrowest point, the Navy ships would hold to the south, dodging between islands belonging to Oman, and hopefully somewhat obscured by the clutter. Next, they'd move south of Abu Musa, past the crowd of oil platforms, again using them for radar cover, and then make a straight run for Dharan, past the many states of Qatar and Bahrain.
Opposition, the intelligence officers said, included ships of American, British, Chinese, Russian, and French origin, all of them armed with one sort of missile or another. The most important ships in the group, of course, were totally unarmed. Maintaining their box formation, Anzio would lead them 2,000 yards in front. Normandy and Yorktown would take position 2,000 yards to starboard, with Jones in trail. The two underway, replenishment ships with O'Bannon and all the frigates in close escort, would form a second decoy group. Helicopters would be aloft both to patrol and, with their radar transponders on, to simulate much larger targets. The various COs agreed on the plan and waited for their helicopters to return them to their commands. It was the first time in ages that an American naval formation had stood in harm's way without a carrier in close support. Their bunkers full of fuel, the group formed up as planned, pointed their bows northwest, and bent on 26 knots. At 1800 local time, a flight of four F-16 fighters blazed overhead, both to give the Aegis ships a chance to practice fire control against live targets, and also to verify the IFF codes to be used for the night's mission. Mohammed Alahad, they saw, was just as ordinary as hell. He'd come to America more than 15 years earlier. He was said to be widowed and childless. He ran a decent and profitable business on one of Washington's nicer shopping streets. He was, in fact, in there right now. Though the closed sign was on the door, they supposed he had nothing better to do but sit in his shop and go over his bills. One of Loomis's squad went up to the shop and knocked on the door. Alahad came to open it, and a brief conversation ensued, with the expected gestures, and they could figure what was being said. "I'm sorry, but all businesses are closed because of the president's order." "Yeah, sure, but I don't have anything to do, and neither do you, right?" "Yes, but it is an order." "Hey, who's gonna know? What do you say?" Finally, the agent went in, wearing a surgical mask. He stayed there for 10 minutes before coming back out, walking around the corner, and making a radio call from his car. "It's a rug shop," the agent told Loomis over the encrypted radio channel. "If we want to toss the place, we'll have to wait." There was already a tap on the phone line, but so far there had not been a single call in or out. The other half of her squad was in Alahad's apartment. There they found a photo of a woman and a child, probably his son, wearing something like a uniform. About 14, the agent thought, photographing them with a Polaroid. But again, everything was pure vanilla. It was exactly the way a businessman would live in the Washington area, or an intelligence officer. You just couldn't tell. They had the beginning of a case, but not enough evidence to take to a judge, certainly not enough for a search warrant. Their probable cause quotient was a little on the thin side. But this was a national security investigation involving the personal safety of the president, and headquarters had told them that there were no rules. They'd already committed two technical violations of the law in invading two apartments without a warrant, and two more in tapping a couple of phone lines. With all that work accomplished, Loomis and Selig made their way into an apartment building across the street. From the manager, they learned that there was a vacant apartment facing Alahad's storefront. They got the keys to that without any difficulty and set up their surveillance of the front, while two more agents watched the back door. Sissy Loomis then used her cellular phone to call headquarters. Maybe it wasn't enough to take to a judge or a U.S. attorney, but it was enough to talk to another agent about. One other potential subject wasn't completely clear yet, O'Day noted. There was Raymond, and a black agent whose wife was a Muslim and who was evidently trying to convert her husband. But the agent had discussed it with his comrades. And there was a notation in his file that this agent's marriage, like others in the service, was on shaky ground. The phone rang. "Inspector O'Day?" "Pat, it's Sissy." "How's Raymond looking?"
He'd worked 3 cases with her, all involving Russian spies. The cheerleader had the jaw of a pit bull once she got onto something. The message on his phone? The wrong number? Yeah. Our rug merchant was calling a dead person whose wife is allergic to wool, Loomis told him. Click. Keep going, sis. She read off her notes and the information garnered by the people who'd entered the dealer's apartment. This one feels real, Pat. The tradecraft is just too good. Right out of the book. It looks so normal that you don't think about it. But why the payphone? Except that he's worried somebody might have a tap on his phone. Why call a dead man by mistake? And why did the wrong number go to somebody on the detail?
Well, Raymond's out of town.
Keep him there, Loomis advised.
They didn't have a case.
They were still struggling for probable cause. If they arrested Alahad, he'd have the sense to ask for a lawyer. And what did they have?
He'd made a phone call. He wouldn't have to defend the call. He just had to say nothing. His lawyer would say it was all some kind of mistake. Alahad might even have a plausible explanation already prepared. He'd keep that one in his pocket, of course. Ask for evidence, and the FBI would have nothing to show.
Well, that tips our hand, too, doesn't it?
Better safe than sorry, Pat.
I have to take this to Dan.
When are you tossing the shop?
Tonight.
The troopers of the Black Horse were thoroughly exhausted. Fit and desert-trained soldiers that they were, they'd spent 2/3 of a day in airplanes with dry air, sitting in cramped seats, their personal weapons in the overhead bins. That always got a curious reaction from the stewardesses, and then arrived 11 time zones away in blazing heat. But they did what they had to do. First came gunnery. The Saudis had established a large shooting range for their own use, with pop-up steel targets as close as 300 meters and as far as 5,000. Gunners bore-sighted their weapons, then tried them out, using real ammunition instead of practice. Then learned that the war shots were far more accurate, the projectiles flying right through the dot, meaning the circular reticle in the center of their sighting systems. Once off the transport trailers, drivers exercised their mounts to make sure that everything worked properly. But the tanks and Bradleys were in the nearly mint condition promised on the flight over. Radio checks were made so that everyone could talk to everyone else. Then they verified the all-important IVUS data links. The more mundane tasks came last of all. The Saudi-deployed M1A2s did not yet have the newest modification to the vehicle series, pallet-loaded ammunition racks. Instead, there was a large steel wire bustle for personal things, especially water. One by one, the crews cycled their vehicles through the course. The Bradley crews even got to fire a single tow missile each. Then they entered the reloading area, taking on new ammunition to replace what had been expended on the range. It was all quiet and businesslike. The Black Horse, because they trained other soldiers so regularly in the fine art of mechanized death, were utterly desensitized to the routine tasks of soldiering. They had to remind themselves that this was not their desert. Deserts all look pretty much alike. This one, however, didn't have creosote bushes and coyotes. It did have camels and merchants. The Saudis honored their hospitality laws by providing food and soft drinks in abundance to the troopers, while their senior officers conferred over maps with the region's bitter coffee. Marion Diggs was not a big man. A cavalryman all of his life, he'd always enjoyed the ability to direct 60 tons of steel with his fingertips, to reach out and touch someone else's vehicle at 3 miles distance. Now he was a senior commander, effectively commanding a division, but with a third of it 200 miles to the north, and another third aboard some ships which would be running a gauntlet later this evening.
"So, what are we really up against? How ready are they?" the general asked.
Satellite photos went down, and the senior American intelligence officer based at KKMC went through his mission brief. It took 30 terse minutes, during which Diggs stood.
He was very tired of sitting. Stormtrack reports minimal radio traffic, the briefing officer, a colonel, reported. We need to remember that they're pretty exposed where they are, by the way.
I have a company moving to cover it, a Saudi officer reported. They should be in position by morning.
What's Buffalo doing? Diggs asked. Another map went down. The Kuwaiti dispositions looked all right to his eye. At least they were not forward deployed. Just the screening force on the berm, he saw, with the three heavy brigades in position to counter a penetration. He knew Magruder. In fact, he knew all three of the ground squadron commanders. If the UIR hit there first, outnumbered or not, the Blue Force would give the Red one hell of a bloody nose.
Enemy intentions? He inquired next.
Unknown, sir. There are elements to this we do not understand yet. Washington has told us to expect an attack, but not why.
What the hell?
Tonight or tomorrow morning for that, best I can tell you, sir, the intel officer replied. Oh, we have newsies assigned to us. They flew in a few hours ago. They're in a hotel in Riyadh.
Marvelous.
In the absence of knowledge of what they plan to do...
The objective is plain, is it not? The senior Saudi commander observed. Our Shiite neighbors have all the desert they need.
He tapped the map.
There is our economic center of gravity.
General? Another voice asked. Diggs turned to his left.
Colonel Eddington?
Center of gravity is political, not military. We might want to keep that in mind, gentlemen, the colonel from Carolina pointed out. If they want to go for the coastal oil fields, we'll have a lot of strategic warning.
They do have us outnumbered, Nick. That does give them a certain degree of strategic flexibility.
Sir, I see a lot of fuel trucks in these photos, the American general noted.
They stopped at the Kuwait border the last time because they were out of fuel, the Saudi commander reminded them.
The Saudi army, actually their National Guard, comprised five heavy brigades, almost all of it American equipment. Three were deployed south of Kuwait, with one at Ras al-Kafji, site of the only invasion of the kingdom, but right on the water, and nobody expected an attack from the sea. It was not unusual for soldiers to prepare to fight the last war, the American remembered. For his part, Eddington remembered a quote from Napoleon. When shown a defense plan that had troops evenly spaced on the French border, he'd asked the officer if the idea was to prevent smuggling. That defensive concept had been given the patina of legitimacy by NATO's doctrine of forward defense on the inner German border, but it had never been tested. And if there were ever a place to trade space for time, it was the Saudi desert. Eddington kept his mouth shut on that one. He was junior to Diggs, and the Saudis seemed quite possessive about their territory, as most people were. He and Diggs shared a look. As the 10th Cav was the theater reserve for the Kuwaitis, so the 11th would perform the same function for the Saudis. That might change when his guardsmen mounted their tracks at Dharan, but for the moment this deployment would have to do. One big problem with the situation was the command relationship in place. Diggs was a one-star. A hell of a good one, Eddington knew, but just a brigadier. Had CENTCOM been able to fly over, he would have had the rank status to make firmer suggestions to the Saudis. Evidently, Colonel Magruder of the Buffalo Cav had done something like that, but Diggs's position was just a little ticklish. Well, we'll have a couple of days anyway. The American general turned. Get additional recon assets in place. If those six divisions fart, I want to know what they had for dinner. We'll have predators going up at sunset, the intel colonel promised. Eddington walked outside to light a cigar. He needn't have troubled himself, he realized after a few puffs. The Saudis all smoked.
Well, Nick, Diggs asked, joining him.
Beer'd be nice.
Just empty calories, the general observed.
4-1 odds, and they have the initiative. That's if my people get their gear in time. This could get right interesting, Diggs.
Another puff.
Their deployments suck. A phrase acquired from his students, his senior thought. By the way, what are we calling this?
Buford. Operation Buford.
Pick a moniker for your brigade, Nick. How's Wolfpack grab you? It's the wrong school, but Tar Heel just doesn't sound right. This damn thing's going pretty fast, General. One lesson the other side must have learned from the last one. Don't give us time to build our forces up. True. Well, I have to see after my people. Use my chopper, Diggs told him. I'll be here a while. Yes, sir. Eddington turned, saluted, and started walking off. Then he turned. Diggs? Yes? Maybe we are not as well trained as Ham and his boys, but we'll get it done, you hear? He saluted again, tossed his cigar, and walked off to the Black Hawk.
Nothing moves as quietly as a ship. An automobile moving at this speed, a fraction below 30 miles per hour, made noise one could hear for hundreds of yards on a silent night. But for a ship, it was the high-frequency swish of steel hull cutting through what were at the moment calm seas. And that didn't carry very far at all. Those aboard could feel the vibrations of the engine, or hear the deep, sucking breath of the turbine engines, but that was all. And those sounds scarcely carried 100 yards across the water at night. Just the swish, and behind every ship was a foaming wake, a ghostly shade of green in the water from tiny organisms upset by the pressure wave of their passage, and phosphorescing as some sort of biological protest to the disturbance. To those on the ships it seemed hellishly bright. On every bridge the lights were turned down, so that night vision wouldn't be compromised. Navigation lights were turned off, a rules-of-the-road violation in these confined waters. Lookouts used conventional binoculars and light amplification gear to scan forward. The formation was just now turning the corner in the narrowest part of the passage. In every combat information center, people hovered over scopes and charts, talking in whispers lest they somehow be heard. Those who smoked wished they could in the antiseptic spaces, and those who'd quit now wondered why. Something about a health hazard, they remembered as they contemplated surface-to-surface missiles mounted in emplacements about 15,000 yards away, each of them with a ton of explosives right behind the seeker head.
Coming left, new course 285, the officer of the deck reported on Anzio.
On the main plot, there were over 40 targets, as radar contacts were called, each with a vector showing approximate course and speed. The number of inbounds and outbounds was about the same. Some of them were huge, the radar returns of supertankers being about that of a medium-sized island.
"Well, we've made it this far," Webb said to Captain Kemper. "Maybe they're asleep."
"Maybe there really is a great pumpkin, Charlie Brown."
Only navigation radars were turning now. The Iranian UIRians had to have ESM gear over there, but if they were standing a patrol in the Strait of Hormuz, they hadn't spotted it yet. There were unexplained targets. Fishing boats, smugglers, somebody in a pleasure craft. There was no telling. Probably the enemy was a little reticent about sending their vessels too far over the centerline of the strait. The Arabs were as territorial as everyone else, Kemper imagined. The ships were all at battle stations. All combat systems were fully powered up, but on standby. If somebody turned toward them, they would first try to get a visual. If somebody lit them up with a targeting radar, then the ship on the clearest bearing would step up her alert level somewhat, and make a few sweeps with the spy radars to see if there might be an inbound track. But that would be tough. Those missiles all had independent seeker heads, and the strait was crowded, and a missile just might acquire something unintended. The other side couldn't be all that trigger-happy. They might even end up slaughtering a few thousand sheep, Kemper thought with a smile. As tense as this part of the mission was, the task for the other side wasn't all that easy.
"Course change on track 4-4 coming left," a quartermaster said.
That one was a surface contact just inside UIREN waters, 7 miles away and passing aft. Kemper leaned